But now it is the time to welcome Dr. Finkelstein. Dr. Finkelstein is the son of two Holocaust survivors, and he grew up in New York. He received his PhD at Princeton, working on a thesis on Zionism. His subsequent academic career saw him teach in different American universities, and he's an activist, a political scientist, and he's the author of 6 books, as I mentioned before, the latest being This Time We Went Too Far. I would say to his supporter, he's an inspiration, and he's a tireless man. He's unique in his outspokenness on the Israel-Palestine conflict. He has continued to do this even at great personal loss. And yet, by holding to his principle and by delivering powerful messages to people via his writing and his lectures, he earned the respect of hundreds of thousands around the globe. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Finkelstein.
Back row? I don't think so. No. Okay, we'll fix it. Just one moment. Can you hear me now? Okay, just in the back row. Raise your hand if you hear me. Okay, good. Well, thank you for having me here. It's been a long week. I've been in several Canadian cities. You can't hear me in the front row. Can you hear me now in the front row? Can you hear me in the back row? How about the middle row? Okay. We started out on the East Coast, which sort of feels like home. And as we progress towards the West Coast, I always get a little bit nervous because I know it's somewhere on the West Coast that the Martians landed and snatched the bodies of your Prime Minister and Mr. Kenny, and that's where they got the idea of the movie The Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And so I get nervous as I come to this part of town. But it seems pretty sane here and really quite beautiful. The big question I was asking the young people as I met them this afternoon is, why aren't there more Americans here? But now I'm told that they are in the suburbs your area. I was taken on a tour, very brief, and I was told everything is perfect in this city, apart from one street. There was one street where there was problems, but otherwise, this is a picture-perfect place to live. Is that accurate? I forgot the name of the street. And I don't want to, I wouldn't say it, because maybe some of you live on it. So, I wouldn't be right. I'll be speaking on the most recent developments in the Israel-Palestine conflict, beginning with what happened in Gaza in 2007-08. Then what happened on the Mavi Marmara on May 31st of this past year. And then I'll do something which I very rarely do, which is to speculate on where things are headed. I don't like to speculate because if your predictions turn out to be wrong, you look rather foolish. But in this case, I think we're moving in such an ominous direction, and the recent developments over the past few days in Lebanon lead one to believe that the moment of truth might be even sooner rather than later than I expected. That I think we have, or I have, some sort of responsibility to put my ego aside, and at the risk of looking silly in retrospect, to discuss or to lay out where things seem to be heading. As I said, I will be focusing, at least initially, on Gaza in 2008-9, but really the story begins in May 2000, when after an 17-year long guerrilla war, the Israelis were evicted from South Lebanon, and it was a major military defeat for the Israelis, one which they were determined to undo. They patiently waited for a pretext, an excuse, an alibi, and it came along in the summer of 2006 when Israel invaded Lebanon again, this time with the intention of inflicting a massive defeat on the Party of God, on the Hezbollah, to undo their defeat in May 2000. Unexpectedly, at least for the Israelis, they suffered another major defeat. And so now there was a succession of military defeats, which the Israelis worried was undermining their deterrence capacity, as they call it. And deterrence capacity is just a fancy technical term, meaning the Arab world's fear of Israel. So after these succession of defeats, they were determined to restore the Arab world's fear of them. And the next place they looked was Gaza, because they didn't think yet they had the option of militarily defeating the Hezbollah. They went into Gaza, wreaked massive destruction and death, but didn't really restore their deterrence capacity, because Gaza, or Hamas, clearly was not a significant fighting force. And so Israel was now, or is now, looking around for another place where they can show that they are the same old fighting force that they were in 1967. Along the way, Israel then suffered two major setbacks in their commando operations. One in the early part of this year in Dubai, and then a second one, to which I'll get to, on the Mavi Marmara. So they had suffered a succession of military defeats, a succession of bungled commando operations, and then they saw before their eyes this coalition forming, which was very reminiscent of that coalition which they alleged threatened them in 1967. But this time it was not, as in 67, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. This time it was Iran, Iraq, Hezbollah, Hamas, and tentatively Turkey under Mr. Erdogan. And so Israel now feels more compelled than ever to to deal some sort of shattering blow in the Arab Muslim world in order to put these uppity Arabs, uppity Muslims, these natives who have gotten restless, to put them back in their place. And judging by most recent accounts, or the most knowledgeable accounts, the place where it's likely to occur is in Lebanon. And as I said, it may actually occur sooner rather than later, with repercussions and consequences which can be so horrifying that no sane person would want to contemplate them. Let me begin with the attack on Gaza in 2008-09. And the background to the attack, I think, is as important as what happened. In January 2006, there were parliamentary elections among the Palestinians in the occupied territories. And unexpectedly, Hamas, the Islamic movement, came out victorious. The elections, according to Jimmy Carter, the former US president, he said they were completely honest and fair. The US and Israel reacted to these completely honest and fair elections by imposing economic sanctions on the people of Gaza to punish them for having elected the wrong party into power. About a year and a half later, in June 2007, Israel, the US, and elements among the Palestinian Authority, they attempted a coup to unseat the legally elected government. Hamas foiled the coup. The Palestinian elements retreated to the West Bank, and now the United States and Israel tightened the blockade on Gaza, a blockade that Amnesty International now called a flagrant violation of international law, a blockade that the Goldstone mission, the mission mandated by the United Nations and headed by the respected international jurist Richard Goldstone, what the Goldstone mission called a possible crime against humanity. The former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, she journeyed to Gaza during these months, and she said, "Gaza's whole civilization has been destroyed. I'm not exaggerating. Its whole civilization has been destroyed." In June 2008, a ceasefire was negotiated by Egypt between Israel and Hamas, and each side, under the terms of the ceasefire, had obligations. Hamas, it was obliged to gradually lift the blockade. Hamas was obliged to stop the rocket and mortar attacks on Israel. And Israel was obliged to gradually lift the blockade of Gaza. According to the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. But Israel refused to lift that blockade of Gaza. That blockade, which is a flagrant violation of international law. The blockade, which was destroying the civilization. What happened next? It's not a matter of controversy. All you have to do is turn to the Amnesty International yearbook for 2008. And here's what Amnesty had to say. A ceasefire agreed in June between Israel and Palestinian armed groups in Gaza. It held for 4.5 months, but it broke down after Israeli forces killed 6 Palestinian militants in airstrikes and other attacks on 4 November. Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Israel refused to lift the blockade, and Israel patiently waited until November 4th. Anyone here remember what November 4th was? Not Britney Spears' birthday. And not Paris Hilton's wedding day. Yes, presidential elections where? United States. Well, there are other countries in the world that elect presidents. You shouldn't be so chauvinist. Yes, the entire media and public was riveted to the results of the US election. And so Israel patiently waited to that day and then invaded Gaza, killing 6 Palestinian militants, knowing full well that it would evoke Palestinian mortar and missile attacks again. And that's exactly what Israel wanted. It was looking for a pretext to launch another attack on Gaza, which had been planned at least as early as March 2007. But you know those Islamicists, those Muslim crazies, they're so fanatical, and so is Hamas. Hamas kept saying fanatically that we're ready to renew the ceasefire. We're ready to renew the ceasefire. But Israel has to lift the blockade of Gaza. Those were the terms of the ceasefire. Israel said no, that Hamas had to unconditionally and unilaterally stop the rocket and mortar attacks, but it would not lift the blockade of Gaza. By this point, Sarah Roy, the Harvard political economist and the world's leading authority on Gaza's economy, she also happens to be the daughter of a survivor of Auschwitz concentration camp. Sarah Roy wrote in December 2008, "The breakdown of an entire society is happening in front of us in Gaza, but there is little international response beyond UN warnings, which are ignored. And now the people of Gaza, they were confronted by 2 stark options. One, they could acquiesce in their gradual destruction. Or 2, they could resist. Hamas chose to resist, although it must be said, the resistance was largely symbolic. Even a former Israeli commander in Gaza, the former IDF commander in Gaza, he said, talking to his fellow Israelis, he said, "You cannot just land blows, leave the Palestinians in Gaza in economic distress, and expect that Hamas will just sit around and do nothing." It's easy enough to condemn Hamas for the rocket and mortar attacks. But those who do condemn them, as does almost all of the human rights organizations, it seems to me that if you condemn them, you still have an obligation to show what other option did they have. If you don't show another option, you're in effect saying that the people of Gaza had a legal and moral obligation to just lie still and die. In any event, Israel decided to expedite the process, and on December 27th, it launched its attack on Gaza. The attack lasted 22 days, what Amnesty International called the 22 days of death and destruction. What happened during those 22 days? Nowadays, when the media, even when reputable human rights organizations, when they refer back to those days, they call it the Gaza War. There was a war in Gaza. And I have little doubt that when history books are written, they will record that episode as the Gaza War. Israel has been emphatic that there was a war in Gaza. They said, after the 22 days, they were very proud of what they had achieved in Gaza and what they had accomplished. They said, now we show those Arabs, those Muslims, who's who and what's what. We've shown them who's in charge in this corner of the world. And how did we show them? Well, Israel said, because we won the war in Gaza. We won the war in Gaza. But then along came an Israeli strategic analyst, and he wrote, it's very dangerous for Israel to believe it won the war when there was no war. In reality, not a single battle was fought during the 22 days of fighting. A former Israeli foreign ministry official, he said there was no war. Hamas sat in its bunkers and came out when it was all over. Well, there was no war in Gaza. What did happen in Gaza? On the military plane,